Side 20, The Bachman Books, Four Early Novels, continuing with The Running Man, on page 618.
"Put that knife down, Mom."
"Nope,"
she cried, but already the crumbling of defeat had begun to putty her face. Heracles closed the door and began walking toward her. He jiggled. She shrank away.
"You have to make him go, son. He's that bad man, that Richards. It'll mean prison or worse. I don't want you to go."
She began to wail, dropped the knife, and collapsed into his arms. He unfolded her and began to rock her gently as she wept.
"I'm not going to jail," he said.
"Come on, Mom, don't cry. Please don't cry." He smiled at Richards over one of her hunched and shaking shoulders, an embarrassed, "awfully sorry about this" smile. Richards waited.
"Now,"
Paracus said, when the sobs had died to sniffles, "Mr. Richards is Bradley Throckmorton's good friend, and he is going to be with us for a couple of days, Mom." She began to shriek, and he clapped a hand over her mouth, wincing as he did so.
"Yes, Mom, yes, he is. I'm going to drive his car into the park and wire it, and you'll go out tomorrow morning with a package to mail to Cleveland."
"Boston," Richards said automatically. "The tapes go to Boston." "They go to Cleveland now," Elton Paracus said with a patient smile. "Bradley's on the run."
"Oh, Jesus." "You'll be on the run, too," Mrs. Paracus howled at her son. "And they'll catch you, too. You're too fat."
"I'm going to take Mr. Richards upstairs and show him his room, Mom."
"Mr. Richards? Mr. Richards? Why don't you call him by his right name, Poison?"
He disengaged her with great gentleness, and Richards followed him obediently up the shadowy staircase. "There are a great many rooms up here," he said, panting slightly as his huge buttocks flexed and clenched.
"This used to be a rooming house many years ago, when I was a baby. You'll be able to watch the street."
"Maybe I better go," Richards said. "If Bradley's blown, your mother may be right."
"This is your room," he said, and threw open a door on a dusty, damp room that held the weight of years.
He did not seem to have heard Richards's comment.
"It's not much of an accommodation, I'm afraid, but..."
He turned to face Richards with his patient, "I want to please" smile. "You may stay as long as you want. Bradley Throckmorton is the best friend I've ever had." The smile faltered a bit. "The only friend I've ever had. I'll watch after my mom. Don't worry." Richards only repeated, "I better go."
"You can't, you know. That head bandage didn't even fool Mom for long."
"I'm going to drive your car to a safe place, Mr. Richards. We'll talk later." He left quickly, lumberingly. Richards noted that the seat of his uniform pants was shiny. He seemed to leave a faint odor of apologia in the room. Pulling the ancient green shade aside a little, Richard saw him emerge on the cracked front walk below and get into the car. Then he got out again. He hurried back toward the house, and Richards felt a stab of fear. Ponderously climbing tread on the stairs, the door opened, and Elton smiled at Richards.
"Mom's right," he said. "I don't make a very good secret agent. I forgot the keys."
Richards gave them to him and then essayed a joke. "Half a secret agent is better than none." It struck a sour chord or no chord at all. Elton Paracus carried his torments with him too clearly, and Richards could almost hear the phantom jeering voices of the children that would follow him forever like small tugs behind a big liner. "Thank you," Richards said softly. Paracus left. And the little car that Richards had come from New Hampshire in was driven away toward the park. Richards pulled the dust cover from the bed and lay down slowly, breathing shallowly and looking at nothing but the ceiling. The bed seemed to clutch him in a perversely damp embrace. Even through the coverlet and his clothes, an odor of mildew drifted through the channels of his nose like a senseless rime. Downstairs, Elton's mother was weeping. -050 and counting. He dozed a little but could not sleep. Darkness was almost full when he heard Elton's heavy tread on the stairs again, and Richards swung his feet onto the floor with relief.
When he knocked and stepped in, Richard saw that Paracus had changed into a tent-like sport shirt and a pair of jeans.
I did it, he said. It's in the park.
Will it be stripped?
No, Elton said. I have a gadget, a battery, and two alligator clips. If anyone puts his hand or a crowbar on it, they'll get a shock and a short blast on a siren. Works good. I built it myself.
He seated himself with a heavy sigh. What's this about Cleveland? Richards demanded. It was easy, he found, to demand of Elton.
Paracus shrugged. Oh, he's a fellow like me. I met him once in Boston at the library with Bradley. Our little pollution club. I suppose Mom said something about that.
He rubbed his hands together and smiled unhappily.
She said something, Richards agreed. She's a little dim, Paracus said. She doesn't understand much of what's been happening for the last 20 years or so. She's frightened all the time.
I'm all she has.
Will they catch Bradley? I don't know. He's got quite a intelligence network.
But his eyes slipped away from Richards's.
The door opened and Mrs. Paracus stood there. Her arms were crossed and she was smiling, but her eyes were haunted.
I've called the police, she said. Now you'll have to go.
Elton's face drained to a pearly yellowish white.
You're lying.
Richards lurched to his feet and then paused, his head cocked in a listening gesture. Faintly, rising, the sound of sirens.
She's not lying, he said. A sickening sense of futility swept him. Back to square one.
Take me to my car.
She's lying, Elton insisted. He rose, almost touched Richards' arm, then withdrew his hand as if the other man might be hot to the touch.
There are fire trucks.
Take me to my car, quick.
The sirens were becoming louder, rising and falling, wailing. The sound filled Richards with a dreamlike horror, locked in here with these two crazies while...
Mother!
His face was twisted, beseeching.
I called them, she blatted, and seized one of her son's bloated arms as if to shake him. I had to, for you. That darkie has got you all mixed up. We'll say he broke in and we'll get the reward money.
Come on, Elton grunted at Richards and tried to shake free of her, but she clung stubbornly, like a small dog bedeviling a percheron.
I had to. You've got to stop this radical business, Elty. You've got to.
Elty, he screamed.
Elty!
And he flung her away. She skidded across the room and fell across the bed.
Quick, Elton said, his face full of terror and misery. Oh, come quick.
They crashed and blundered down the stairs and out the front door, Elton breaking into gigantic, quivering trot. He was beginning to pant again. And upstairs, filtering both through the closed window and the open door downstairs, Mrs. Paracus's scream rose to a shriek which met and mixed and blended with the approaching sirens.
I did it for you!
-049 and counting. Their shadows chased them down the hill toward the park, waxing and waning as they approached and passed each of the mesh-enclosed GA street lamps. Elton Paracus breathed like a locomotive, in huge and windy gulps and hisses. They crossed the street, and suddenly headlights picked them out on the far sidewalk in hard relief. Blue flashing lights blazed on as the police car came to a screeching, jamming halt 100 yards away.
Richards! Ben Richards! Gigantic, megaphone booming voice.
Your car? Up ahead. See?
Elton panted. Richards could just make the car out. Elton had parked it well, under a copse of run-to-seed birch trees near the pond. The cruiser suddenly screamed into life again, rear tires bonding hot rubber to the pavement in lines of acceleration. Its gasoline-powered engine wailing in climbing revolutions. It slammed up over the curb, headlights skyrocketing, and came down pointing directly at them. Richards turned toward it, suddenly feeling very cool, feeling almost numb. He dragged Bradley's pistol out of his pocket, still backing up. The rest of the cops weren't in sight, just this one. The car screamed at them across the October bare ground of the park, self-sealing rear tires digging out great clods of ripped black earth. He squeezed off 2 shots at the windshield. It starred but did not shatter. He leaped aside at the last second and rolled, dry grass against his face. Upon his knees, he fired 2 more at the back of the car, and then it was coming around in a hard, slewing power turn, blue lights turning the night into a crazy, shadow-leaping nightmare. The cruiser was between him and the car, but Elton had leaped the other way and was now working frantically to remove his electrical device from the car door. Someone was halfway out of the passenger side of the police car, which was on its way again. A thick stuttering sound filled the dark. Sten gun. Bullets dug through the turf around him in a senseless pattern. Dirt struck his cheeks, pattered against his forehead. He knelt as if praying and fired again into the windshield. This time the bullet punched a hole through the glass. The car was on top of him. He sprang to the left, and the reinforced steel bumper struck his left foot, snapping his ankle and sending him sprawling on his face. The cruiser's engine rose to a supercharged scream, digging through another power turn. Now the headlights were on him again, turning everything stark monochrome. Richards tried to get up, but his broken ankle wouldn't support him. Sobbing in great gulps of air, he watched the police car loom again. Everything became heightened, surreal. He was living in an adrenaline delirium, and everything seemed slow, deliberate, orchestrated. The approaching police car was like a huge blind buffalo. The Sten gun rattled again, and this time a bullet punched through his left arm, knocking him sideways. The heavy car tried to veer and get him, and for a moment he had a clear shot at the figure behind the wheel. He fired once, and the window blew inward. The car screamed into a slow, digging sidewards roll, then went up and over, crashing down on the roof and then onto its side. The motor stalled, and in sudden shocking silence, the police radio crackled clearly. Richards could still not get to his feet, and so he began to crawl toward the car. Perikis was in it now, trying to start it, but in his blind panic he must have forgotten to lever the safety vents open. Each time he turned the key, there was only a hollow, coughing boom of air in the chambers. The night began to fill up with converging sirens. He was still 50 yards from the car when Elton realized what was wrong and yanked down the vent lever. The next time he turned the key, the engine chopped erratically into life, and the air car swept toward Richards. He got to a half-standing position and tore the passenger door open and fell inside. Perikis banked left onto Route 77, which intersected State Street above the park, the lower deck of the car no more than an inch from the paving, almost low enough to drag and spill them. Elton gulped in huge swatches of air and let them out with force enough to flap his lips like window blinds. Two more police cars screamed around the corner behind them, the blue lights flashed on, and they gave chase. "We're not fast enough," Elton screamed. "We're not fast! They're on wheels!" Richards yelled back. "Cut through that vacant lot!" The air car banked left, and they were slammed upward violently as they crossed the curb. The battering air pressure shoved them into drive. The police cars swelled behind them, and then they were shooting. Richards heard steel fingers punching holes in the body of their car. Their rear window blew in with a tremendous crash, and they were sprinkled with fragments of safety glass. Screaming, Elton whipped the air car left and right. One of the police cars, doing 60-plus, lost it coming up over the curb. The car veered wildly, revolving blue dome lights splitting the darkness with lunatic bolts of light, and then it crashed over on its side, digging a hot groove through the littered moraine of the empty lot, until a spark struck its peeled-back gas tank. It exploded whitely like a road flare. The second car was following the road again, but Elton beat them. They had cut the cruiser off, but it would gain back the lost distance very shortly. The gas-driven ground cars were nearly 3 times faster than air drive, and if an air car tried to go too far off the road, the uneven surface beneath the thrusters would flip the car over, as Perikis had nearly flipped them crossing the curb. "Turn right," Richards cried. Perikis pulled them around in another grinding, stomach-lurching turn. They were on Route 1. Ahead, Richards could see that they would soon be forced up the entranceway to the Coast Turnpike. No evasive action would be possible there. Only death would be possible there. "Turn off! Turn off, goddammit, that alley!" For a moment, the police car was one turn behind them, lost from view. "No, no!" Perikis was gibbering now. "We'll be like rats in a trap!" Richards leaned over and hauled the wheel around, knocking Elton's hand from the throttle with the same gesture. The air car skidded around in a nearly 90-degree turn. They bounced off the concrete of the building on the left of the alley's mouth, sending them in at a crooked angle. The blunt nose of the car struck a pile of heaped trash, garbage cans, and splintered crates. Behind these, solid brick. Richards was pitched violently into the dashboard as they crashed, and his nose broke with a sudden snap, gushing blood with violent force. The air car lay askew in the alley, one cylinder still coughing a little. Perikis was a silent lump lolling over the steering wheel. There was no time for him yet. Richard slammed his shoulder against the crimped passenger door. It popped open, and he hopped on one leg to the mouth of the alley. He reloaded his gun from the crumpled box of shells Bradley had supplied him with. They were greasy, cool to the touch. He dropped some of them around his feet. His arm had begun to throb like an ulcerated tooth, making him feel sick and nauseated with pain. Headlights turned the deserted city expressway from night to sunless day. The cruiser skidded around the turn, rear tires fighting for traction, sending up the fragrant smell of seared rubber. Looping black marks scored the expansion joint macadam in parabolas. Then it was leaping forward again. Richards held the gun in both hands, leaning against the building to his left. In a moment they would realize they could see no taillights ahead. The cop riding shotgun would see the alley. No. Snuffling blood through his broken nose, he began to fire. The range was nearly point blank, and at this distance, the high-powered slugs smashed through the bulletproof glass as if it had been paper. Each recoil of the heavy pistol pulsed through his wounded arm, making him scream. The car roared up over the curb, flew a short wingless distance, and crashed into the blank brick wall across the street. Echo Free V Repair, a faded sign on this wall read, "Because you watch it, we won't botch it." The police car, still a foot above the ground, met the brick wall at high speed and exploded. But others were coming. Always others. Panting, Richards made his way back to the air car. His good leg was very tired. "I'm hurt," Paracus was groaning hollowly. "I'm hurt so bad. Where's Mom? Where's my mama?" Richards fell on his knees, wriggled under the air car on his back, and began to pull trash and debris from the air chambers like a madman. Blood ran down his cheeks from his ruptured nose and pooled beside his ears. -048, and counting. The car would only run on 5 of its 6 cylinders, and it would go no faster than 40, leaning drunkenly to one side. Paracus directed him from the passenger seat, where Richards had manhandled him. The steering column had gone into his abdomen like a rail spike, and Richards thought he was dying. The blood on the dented steering wheel was warm and sticky on Richards' palms. "I'm very sorry," Paracus said. "Turn left here. It's really my fault. I should have known better. She doesn't think straight. She doesn't..." He coughed up a glut of black blood and spat it listlessly into his lap. The sirens filled the night, but they were far behind and off to the west. They had gone out marginal way, and from there Paracus had directed him onto back roads. Now they were on Route 9 going north, and the Portland suburbs were petering out into October barren scrub countryside. The strip lumberers had been through like locusts, and the end result was a bewildering tangle of second growth and marsh. "Do you know where you're telling me to go?" Richards asked. He was a huge brand of pain from one end to the other. He was quite sure his ankle was broken. There was no doubt at all about his nose. His breath came through it in flattened gasps. "To a place I know," Elton Paracus said, and coughed up more blood. "She used to tell me a boy's best friend is his mom. Can you believe that? I used to believe it. Will they hurt her? Take her to jail?" "No," Richard said shortly, not knowing if they would or not. It was 8:20. He and Elton had left the Blue Door at 7:10. It seemed as if decades had passed. A far distance off, more sirens were joining in the general chorus. "The unspeakable in pursuit of the inedible," Richards thought disjointedly. "If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen." He had dispatched 2 police cars single-handed. Another bonus for Sheila. Blood money. And Kathy. Would Kathy sicken and die on milk paid for with bounty cash? "How are you, my darlings? I love you. Here on this twisting, crazy back road, fit only for deer jackers and couples looking for a good make-out spot, I love you and wish that your dreams be sweet. I wish..." "Turn left," Elton croaked. Richards swung left up a smooth, tarred road that cut through a tangle of denuded sumac and elm, pine and spruce, scrubby nightmare second growth. A river, ripe and sulfurous with industrial waste, smote his nose. Low-hanging branches scraped the roof of the car with skeleton screeches. They passed a sign which read, "Super Pine Tree Mall, under construction. Keep out. Trespassers will be prosecuted." They topped a final rise, and there was the Super Pine Tree Mall. Work must have stopped at least 2 years ago, Richards thought, and things hadn't been too advanced when it did. The place was a maze, a rat warren of half-built stores and shops, discarded lengths of pipe, piles of cinder block and boards, shacks and rusted Quonset huts, all overgrown with scrubby junipers and laurels and witchgrass and blue spruce, blackberry and blackthorn, devil's paintbrush and denuded goldenrod. And it stretched on for miles. Gaping oblong foundation holes like graves dug for Roman gods. rusted skeleton steel. Cement walls with steel core rods protruding like shadowy cryptograms. Bulldozed oblongs that were to be parking lots now grassed over. Somewhere overhead, an owl flew on stiff and noiseless wings, hunting.
Help me. Into the driver's seat.
You're in no condition to drive, Richard said, pushing hard on his door to open it.
It's the least I can do,
Elton Perikov said with grave and bloody absurdity.
I'll play hare. Drive as long as I can.
No, Richard said.
Let me go!
He screamed at Richards, his fat baby face terrible and grotesque.
I'm dying and you just better let me go.
He trailed off into hideous silent coughs that brought up fresh gouts of blood. It smelled very moist in the car, like a slaughterhouse.
Help me, he whispered. I'm too fat to do it by myself. Oh, God, please help me do this.
Richards helped him. He pushed and heaved, and his hands slipped and squelched in Elton's blood. The front seat was an abattoir. And Elton, who'd have thought anyone could have so much blood in him, continued to bleed. Then he was wedged behind the wheel, and the air car was rising jaggedly, turning. The brake lights blinked on and off, and the car bunted at trees lightly before Elton found the road out. Richards thought he would hear the crash, but there was none. The erratic thumpa-thumpa-thumpa of the air cylinders grew fainter, beating in the deadly one-cylinder flat rhythm that would burn out the others in an hour or so. The sound faded. Then there was no sound at all but the faraway buzz of a plane. Richards realized belatedly that he had left the crutches he had purchased for disguise purposes in the back of the car. The constellations whirled indifferently overhead. He could see his breath in small frozen puffs. It was colder tonight. He turned from the road and plunged into the jungle of the construction site. Minus 047 and counting. He spied a pile of cast-off insulation lying in the bottom of a cellar hole and climbed down, using the protruding core rods for handholds. He found a stick and pounded the insulation to scare out the rats. He was rewarded with nothing but a thick fibrous dust that made him sneeze and yelp with the pain burst in his badly used nose. No rats. All the rats were in the city. He uttered a harsh bray of laughter that sounded jagged and splintered in the big dark. He wrapped himself in strips of the insulation until he looked like a human igloo, but it was warm. He leaned back against the wall and fell into a half-doze. When he roused fully, a late moon, no more than a cold scrap of light, hung over the eastern horizon. He was still alone. There were no sirens. It might have been 3 o'clock. His arm throbbed uneasily, but the flow of blood had stopped on its own. He saw this after pulling the arm out of the insulation and brushing the fibers gently away from the cloth. The Sten Gun bullet had apparently ripped a fairly large triangular hunk of meat from the side of his arm just above the elbow. He supposed he was lucky that the bullet hadn't smashed the bone, but his ankle throbbed with a steady, deep ache. The foot itself felt strange and ethereal, barely attached. He supposed the break should be splintered. Supposing he dozed again. When he woke, his head was clearer. The moon had risen halfway up in the sky, but there was still no sign of dawn, true or false. He was forgetting something. It came to him in a nasty, jolting realization. He had to mail 2 tape clips before noon, if they were to get to the games building by the 6:30 airtime. That meant traveling or defaulting the money. But Bradley was on the run, or captured. And Elton Perikus had never given him the Cleveland name. And his ankle was broken. Something large, a deer, weren't they extinct in the east, suddenly crashed through the underbrush off to his right, making him jump. Insulation slid off him like snakes, and he pulled it back around himself miserably, snuffling through his broken nose. He was a city dweller, sitting in a deserted development, gone back to the wild in the middle of nowhere. The night suddenly seemed alive and malevolent, frightening of its own self, full of crazed bumps and creaks. Richards breathed through his mouth, considering his options and their consequences. 1. Do nothing. Just sit here and wait for things to cool off. Consequence? The money he was piling up, $100 an hour, would be cut off at 6 tonight. He would be running for free, but the hunt wouldn't stop, not even if he managed to avoid them for the whole 30 days. The hunt would continue until he was carried off on a board. 2. Mail the clips to Boston. It couldn't hurt Bradley or the family because their cover was already blown. Consequences: 1. The tapes would undoubtedly be sent to Harding by the hunters watching Bradley's mail, but 2. They would still be able to trace him directly to wherever he mailed the tapes from with no intervening Boston postmark. 3. Mail the tapes directly to the Games building in Harding. Consequences: the hunt would go on, but he would probably be recognized in any town big enough to command a mailbox. They were all lousy choices. Thank you, Mrs. Perricus. Thank you. He got up, brushing the insulation away, and tossed the useless head bandage on top of it. As an afterthought, he buried it in the insulation. He began hunting around for something to use as a crutch. The irony of leaving the real crutches in the car struck him again. And when he found a board that reached approximately to armpit height, he threw it over the lip of the cellar foundation and began to climb laboriously back up the core rods. When he got to the top, sweating and shivering simultaneously, he realized that he could see his hands. The first faint gray light of dawn had begun to probe the darkness. He looked longingly at the deserted development, thinking, it would have made such a fine hiding place. No good. He wasn't supposed to be a hiding man, he was a running man. Wasn't that what kept the ratings up? A cloudy, cataract-like ground mist was creeping slowly through the denuded trees. Richards paused to get his directions, and then struck off toward the woods that bordered the abandoned Super Mall on the north. He paused only once to wrap his coat around the top of his crutch, and then continued. -046, and counting. It had been full daylight for 2 hours, and Richards had almost convinced himself he was going around in large circles, when he heard, through the rank brambles and ground bushes up ahead, the whine of air cars. He pushed on cautiously, and then peered out on a 2-lane macadam highway. Cars rushed to and fro with fair regularity. About half a mile up, Richards could make out a cluster of houses and what was either an air station or an old general store with pumps in front. He pushed on, paralleling the highway, falling over occasionally. His face and hands were a needle point of blood from briars and brambles, and his clothes were studded with brown sticker balls. He had given up trying to brush them away. Burst milkweed pods floated lightly from both shoulders, making him look as if he had been in a pillow fight. He was wet from top to toe. He had made it through the first 2 brooks, but in the third his crutch had slipped on the treacherous bottom, and he had fallen headlong. The camera, of course, was undamaged. It was waterproof and shockproof, of course. The bushes and trees were thinning. Richards got down on his hands and knees and crawled. When he had gone as far as he thought he safely could, he studied the situation. He was on a slight rise of land, a peninsula of the scrubby second-growth weeds he had been walking through. Below him was the highway, a number of ranch-type houses, and a store with air pumps. The car was in there now, being attended to, while the driver, a man in a suede windbreaker, chatted with the air jockey. Beside the store, along with 3 or 4 gumball machines and a Mary Jane vendor, stood a blue and red mailbox. It was only 200 yards away. Looking at it, Richards realized bitterly that if he had arrived before first light, he could have probably done his business unseen. Well, spilt milk and all that. The best laid plans of mice and men. He withdrew until he could set up his camera and do his taping without being seen. "Hello, all you wonderful people out there in Freeveland," he began. "This is Jovial Ben Richards, taking you on my annual nature hike. If you look closely, you may see the fearless scarlet tanager, or a great speckled cowbird, perhaps even a yellow-bellied pigbird or two." He paused. "They may let that part through, but not the rest. If you're deaf and read lips, remember what I'm saying. Tell a neighbor or a friend. Spread the word. The network is poisoning the air you breathe and denying you cheap protection because..." He recorded both tapes and put them in his pants pocket. Okay, what next? The only possible way to do it was to go down with the gun drawn, deposit the tapes, and run.
He could steal a car. It wasn't as if they weren't going to know where he was anyway. Randomly, he wondered how far Perikis had gotten before they cut him down. He had the gun out and in his fist when he heard the voice, startlingly close, seemingly in his left ear. "Come on, Rolf." There was a sudden volley of barks that made Richards jump violently, and he had just time to think, "Police dogs! Christ, they've got police dogs!" when something huge and black broke cover and arrowed at him. The gun was knocked into the brush, and Richards was on his back. The dog was on top of him, a big German shepherd with a generous streak of mongrel, lapping his face and drooling on his shirt. His tail flagged back and forth in vigorous semaphores of joy. "Rolf! Hey, Rolf! Oh, God!" Richards caught an obscured glimpse of running legs in blue jeans, and then a small boy was dragging the dog away. "Geez, I'm sorry, mister. Geez, he don't bite. He's too dumb to bite. He's just friendly. He ain't... God, ain't you a mess? You get lost?" The boy was holding Rolf by the collar and staring at Richards with frank interest. He was a good-looking boy, well-made, perhaps 11, and there was none of the pale and patched inner-city look on his face. There was something suspicious and alien in his features, yet familiar also. After a moment, Richards placed it. It was innocence. "Yes," he said dryly, "I got lost." "Gee, you sure must have fallen around some." "That I did, pal. You want to take a close look at my face and see if it's scratched up very badly? I can't see it, you know." The boy leaned forward obediently and scanned Richards' face. No sign of recognition flickered there. Richards was satisfied. "It's all Burkott," the boy said. There was a delicate New England twang in his voice. Not exactly down east, but lightly springy, sardonic. "But you'll live." His brow furrowed. "You escaped from Thomaston? I know you ain't from Pineland, because you don't look like a retard." "I'm not escaped from anywhere," Richard said, wondering if that was a lie or the truth. "I was hitchhiking. Bad habit, pal. You never do it, do you?" "No way," the boy said earnestly. "There's crazy dudes running the roads these days. That's what my dad says." "He's right," Richard said. "But I just had to get to, He snapped his fingers in a pantomime of, "It just slipped my mind. You know, Jetport. You must mean Voight Field. That's it." "Geez, that's over 100 miles from here, mister, in Derry." "I know," Richard said ruefully, and ran a hand over Rolf's fur. The dog rolled over obligingly and played dead. Richards fought an urge to utter a morbid chuckle. "I picked up a ride at the New Hampshire border with these three maggots. Real tough guys. They beat me up, stole my wallet, and dumped me at some deserted shopping center." "Yeah, I know that place. Cripes, you want to come down to the house and have some breakfast?" "I'd like to, bucko, but time's wasting. I have to get to that Jetport by tonight." "You going to hitch another lift?" The boy's eyes were round. "Got to." Richard started to get up, then settled back as if a great idea had struck him. "Listen, do me a favor." "I guess so," the boy said cautiously. Richards took out the two exposed tape clips. "These are charge plate cash vouchers," he said glibly. "If you drop them in a mailbox for me, my company will have a lump of cash waiting for me in Derry. Then I'll be on my merry way."
"Even without an address?"
"These go direct," Richards said.
"Sure. Okay. There's a mailbox down at Gerald's store."
He got up, his inexperienced face unable to disguise the fact that he thought Richards was lying in his teeth.
"Come on, Rolf."
He let the boy get 15 feet and then said,
"No, come here again."
The boy turned and came back with his feet dragging. There was dread on his face. Of course, there were enough holes in Richards' story to drive a truck through. "I've got to tell you everything, I guess," Richards said. "I was telling you the truth about most of it, pal, but I didn't want to risk the chance that you might blab." The morning October sun was wonderfully warm on his back and neck, and he wished he could stay on the hill all day and sleep sweetly in fall's fugitive warmth. He pulled the gun from where it had fallen and let it lie loosely on the grass. The boy's eyes went wide. "Government," Richard said quietly.
"Jesus,"
the boy whispered. Rolf sat beside him, his pink tongue lolling rakishly from the side of his mouth. "I'm after some pretty hard guys, kid. You can see that they worked me over pretty well. Those clips you got there have got to get through."
"I'll mail them," the boy said breathlessly.
"Geez, wait till I tell..." "Nobody," Richard said. "Tell nobody for 24 hours.
There might be reprisals, he added ominously. So until tomorrow this time, you never saw me, understand?
Yeah, sure.
Then get on it. And thanks, pal. He held out his hand, and the boy shook it awfully. Richards watched them trot down the hill, a boy in a red plaid shirt with his dog crashing joyfully through the goldenrod beside him. Why can't my Kathy have something like that? His face twisted into a terrifying and wholly unconscious grimace of rage and hate, and he might have cursed God himself if a better target had not interposed itself on the dark screen of his mind, the Games Federation. And behind that, like the shadow of a darker god, the Network. He watched until he saw the boy, made tiny with distance, drop the tapes into the mailbox. Then he got up stiffly, propping his crutch under him, and crashed back into the brush, angling toward the road. The jetport, then. And maybe someone else would pay some dues before it was all over. -045 and counting. He had seen an intersection a mile back, and Richards left the woods there, making his way awkwardly down the gravel bank between the woods and the road. He sat there like a man who has given up trying to hook a ride and has decided to enjoy the warm autumn sun instead. He let the first two cars go by. Both of them held two men, and he figured the odds were too high. But when the third one approached the stop sign, he got up. The closing-in feeling was back. This whole area had to be hot, no matter how far Paracus had gotten. The next car could be police, and that would be the ballgame. It was a woman in the car, and she was alone. She would not look at him. Hitchhikers were distasteful, and thus to be ignored. He ripped the passenger door open and was in, even as the car was accelerating again. He was picked up and thrown sideways, one hand holding desperately onto the door jamb, his good foot dragging. The thumping hiss of brakes, the air car swerved wildly.
What? Who? You can't...
Richards pointed the gun at her, knowing he must look grotesque close up, like a man who had been run through a meat grinder. The fierce image would work for him. He dragged his foot in and slammed the door, gun never swerving. She was dressed for town and wore blue wraparound sunglasses, good-looking from what he could see. Wheel it, Richards said. She did the predictable, slammed both feet on the brake and screamed. Richards was thrown forward, his bad ankle scraping excruciatingly. The air car juddered to a stop on the shoulder, 50 feet beyond the intersection.
You're that...
Ben Richards. Take your hands off the wheel, put them in your lap. She did it, shuddering convulsively. She would not look at him. Afraid, Richards supposed, that she would be turned to stone. What's your name, ma'am?
Amelia Williams. Don't shoot me. Don't kill me. You can have my money, only for God's sake, don't kill me!
Shh, Richard said soothingly. Shh, shh. When she had quieted a little, he said, I won't try to change your mind about me, Mrs. Williams. Is it Mrs.?
Yes, she said automatically.
But I have no intention of harming you. Do you understand that?
Yes, she said, suddenly eager. You want the car. They got your friend, and now you need a car. You can take it. It's insured. I won't even tell. I swear I won't. I'll say someone stole it in the parking lot.
We'll talk about it, Richard said. Begin to drive. Go up Route 1 and we'll talk about it. Are there roadblocks?
Yes, hundreds of them. They'll catch you.
Don't lie, Mrs. Williams, okay? She began to drive, erratically at first, then more smoothly. The motion seemed to soothe her. Richards repeated his question about roadblocks.
Around Lewiston, she said with frightened unhappiness. That's where they got that other mag... fellow.
How far is that?
30 miles or more.
Paracus had gotten farther than Richards would have dreamed.
Will you rape me?
Amelia Williams asked so suddenly that Richards almost barked with laughter.
No,
he said. Then, matter-of-factly, I'm married.
I saw her, she said, with a kind of smirking doubtfulness that made Richards want to smash her.
Eat garbage, bitch. Kill a rat that was hiding in the bread box, kill it with a whisk broom, and then see how you talk about my wife.
Can I get off here? She asked pleadingly, and he felt a trifle sorry for her again.
No, he said. You're my protection, Mrs. Williams. I have to get to Voigt Field in a place called Derry. You're going to see that I get there.
That's 150 miles,
she wailed. Someone else told me 100.
They were wrong. You'll never get through to there.
I might, Richard said, and then looked at her. And so might you if you play it right. She began to tremble again, but said nothing. Her attitude was that of a woman waiting to wake up. Minus 044 and counting. They traveled north through autumn, burning like a torch. The trees were not dead this far north, murdered by the big poisonous smokes of Portland, Manchester, and Boston. They were all hues of yellow, red, brilliant starburst purple. They awoke in Richards an aching feeling of melancholy. It was a feeling he never would have suspected his emotions could have harbored only 2 weeks before. In another month, the snow would fly and cover all of it. Things ended in fall. She seemed to sense his mood and said nothing. The driving filled the silence between them, lulled them. They passed over the water at Yarmouth. Then there were only woods and trailers and miserable poverty shacks with outhouses tacked on the sides. Yet one could always spot the Freevee cable attachment bolted on below a sagging paintless windowsill or beside a hinge-smashed door, winking and heliographing in the sun. Until they entered Freeport. There were three police cruisers parked just outside of town, the cops meeting in a kind of roadside conference. The woman stiffened like a wire, her face desperately pale, but Richards felt calm. They passed the police without notice, and she slumped. If they had been monitoring traffic, they would have been on us like a shot, Richards said casually. You might as well paint Ben Richards is in this car on your forehead in Dayglow. Why can't you let me go? She burst out, and in the same breath, have you got a J? Rich folks blow dokes. The thought brought a bubble of ironic laughter, and he shook his head. You're laughing at me? She asked, stung. You've got some nerve, don't you? You cowardly little murderer, scaring me half out of my life, probably planning to kill me the way you killed those poor boys in Boston. There was a full gross of those poor boys, Richard said. Ready to kill me. That's their job. Killing for pay. Ready to do anything for money. Wanting to overturn the country. Why don't you find decent work? Because you're too lazy. Your kind spit in the face of anything decent. Are you decent? Richards asked. Yes, she stormed. Isn't that why you picked on me? Because I was defenseless and decent? So you could use me, drag me down to your level, and then laugh about it? If you're so decent, how come you have $6,000 to buy this fancy car, while my little girl dies of the flu? What? She looked startled. Her mouth started to open, and she closed it with a snap. You're an enemy of the network, she said. It says so on the freebie. I saw some of those disgusting things you did. You know what's disgusting? Richards asked, lighting a cigarette from the pack on the dashboard. I'll tell you. It's disgusting to get blackballed because you don't want to work in a General Atomics job that's going to make you sterile. It's disgusting to sit home and watch your wife earning the grocery money on her back. It's disgusting to know the network is killing millions of people each year with air pollutants when they could be manufacturing nose filters for $6 a throw. You lie, she said. Her knuckles had gone white on the wheel. When this is over, Richard said, you can go back to your nice split-level duplex and light up a doke and get stoned and love the way your new silverware sparkles in the highboy. No one fighting rats with broom handles in your neighborhood or shitting by the back stoop because the toilet doesn't work. I met a little girl 5 years old with lung cancer. How's that for disgusting? Stop, she screamed at him. You talk dirty. That's right, he said, watching as the countryside flowed by. Hopelessness filled him like cold water. There was no base of communication with these beautiful chosen ones. They existed up where the air was rare. He had a sudden raging urge to make this woman pull over, knock her sunglasses onto the gravel, drag her through the dirt, make her eat a stone, rape her, jump on her, knock her teeth into the air like startled digits, strip her nude and ask her if she was beginning to see the big picture. The one that runs 24 hours a day on Channel 1. For the national anthem never plays before the sign-off. That's right, he muttered. Dirty-talking old me.
minus 043, and counting. They got farther than they had any right to, Richards figured. They got all the way to a pretty town by the sea called Camden, over 100 miles from where he had hitched a ride with Amelia Williams. "Listen," he said as they were entering Augusta, the state capital, "there's a good chance they'll sniff us here. I have no interest in killing you, dig it?"
"Yes," she said.
Then with bright hate, "You need a hostage."
"Right.
So if a cop pulls out behind us, you pull over, immediately. You open your door and lean out. Just lean. Your fanny is not to leave that seat, understand?"
"Yes."
"You holler, 'Benjamin Richards is holding me hostage. If you don't give him free passage, he'll kill me.'"
"And you think that will work?"
"It better," he said with tense mockery. "It's your ass." She bit her lip and said nothing. "It'll work, I think. There'll be 12 freelance cameramen around in no time, hoping to get some games money, or even the Zapruder Award itself. With that kind of publicity, they'll have to play it straight. Sorry you won't get to see us go out in a hail of bullets so they can talk about you sanctimoniously as Ben Richards' last victim."
"Why do you say these things?"
she burst out. He didn't reply, only slid down in his seat until just the top of his head showed, and waited for the blue lights in the rearview mirror. But there were no blue lights in Augusta. They continued on for 1.5 hours, skirting the ocean as the sun began to wester, catching little glints and peaks of the water, across fields and beyond bridges and through heavy firs. It was past 2 o'clock when they rounded a bend not far from the Camden town line and saw a roadblock. 2 police cars parked on either side of the road. 2 cops were checking a farmer in an old pickup and waving it through. "Go 200 feet and then stop," Richard said. "Do it just the way I told you." She was pallid but seemingly in control. Resigned, maybe. She applied the brakes evenly and the air car came to a neat stop in the middle of the road 50 feet from the checkpoint. The trooper holding the clipboard waved her forward imperiously. When she didn't come, he glanced inquiringly at his companion. A 3rd cop, who had been sitting inside one of the cruisers with his feet up, suddenly grabbed the hand mic under the dash and began to speak rapidly. "Here we go," Richards thought. "Oh, God, here we go." Minus 042, and counting. The day was very bright. The constant rain of Harding seemed light years away. And everything was very sharp and clearly defined. The trooper's shadows might have been drawn with black Crayolas. They were unhooking the narrow straps that crossed their gun butts. Mrs. Williams swung open the door and leaned out. "Don't shoot, please," she said. And for the first time, Richards realized how cultured her voice was, how rich. She might have been in a drawing room, except for the pallid knuckles and the fluttering bird-like pulse in her throat. With the door open, he could smell the fresh, invigorating odor of pine and timothy grass. "Come out of the car with your hands over your head," the cop with the clipboard said. He sounded like a well-programmed machine. General Atomics Model 6925-A9, Richards thought. The Hicksville Trooper, 16 PSM iridium batteries included, comes in white only. "You and your passenger, ma'am, we see him."
"My name is Amelia Williams," she said very clearly. "I can't get out as you ask. Benjamin Richards is holding me hostage. If you don't give him free passage, he says he'll kill me."
The 2 cops looked at each other, and something barely perceptible passed between them. Richards, with his nerves strung up to a point where he seemed to be operating with a 7th sense, caught it.
"Drive!"
he screamed. She stared around at him, bewildered.
"But they won't..."
The clipboard clattered to the road. The 2 cops fell into the kneeling posture almost simultaneously, guns out, gripped in right hands, left hands holding right wrists, one on each side of the solid white line. The sheets of flimsy on the clipboard fluttered errantly. Richards tromped his bad foot on Amelia Williams's right shoe, his lips drawing back into a tragedy mask of pain as the broken ankle grated. The air car ripped forward. The next moment, 2 hollow punching noises struck the car, making it vibrate. A moment later, the windshield blew in, splattering them both with bits of safety glass. She threw both hands up to protect her face, and Richards leaned savagely against her, swinging the wheel. They shot through the gap between the V'd cars, with scarcely a flirt of the rear deck. He caught a crazy glimpse of the troopers whirling to fire again, and then his whole attention was on the road. They mounted a rise, and then there was one more hollow thun as a bullet smashed a hole in the trunk. The car began to fishtail, and Richards hung on, whipping the wheel in diminishing arcs. He realized dimly that Williams was screaming. "Steer!" he shouted at her. "Steer, goddammit! Steer! Steer!" Her hands groped reflexively for the wheel and found it. He let go and batted the dark glasses away from her eyes with an open-handed blow. They hung on one ear for a moment and then dropped off. "Pull over!"
"They shot at us!"
Her voice began to rise. "They shot at us! They shot at—" "Pull over!" The scream of sirens rose behind them. She pulled over clumsily, sending the car around in a shuddering half-turn that spumed gravel into the air.
"I told them and they tried to kill us," she said wonderingly. "They tried to kill us."
But he was out already, out and hopping clumsily back the way they had come, gun out. He lost his balance and fell heavily, scraping both knees. When the first cruiser came over the rise, he was in a sitting position on the shoulder of the road, the pistol held firmly at shoulder level. The car was doing 80 easily and still accelerating. Some back road cowboy at the wheel with too much engine up front and visions of glory in his eyes. They perhaps saw him, perhaps tried to stop. It didn't matter. There were no bulletproof tires on these. The one closest to Richards exploded as if there had been dynamite inside. The cruiser took off like a big-ass bird, gunning across the shoulder in howling, uncontrolled flight. It crashed into the hole of a huge elm. The driver's side door flew off. The driver rammed through the windshield like a torpedo and flew 30 yards before crashing into the pucker brush. The second car came almost as fast, and it took Richards 4 shots to find a tire. 2 slugs splattered sand next to his spot. This one slid around in a smoking half-turn and rolled 3 times, spraying glass and metal. Richards struggled to his feet, looked down, and saw his shirt darkening slowly just above the belt. He hopped back toward the air car and then dropped on his face as the second cruiser exploded, spewing shrapnel above and around him. He got up, panting and making strange whimpering noises in his mouth. His side had begun to throb in slow, aching cycles. She could have gotten away, perhaps, but she had made no effort. She was staring transfixed at the burning police car in the road. When Richards got in, she shrank from him.
"You killed them. You killed those men."
"They tried to kill me." "You too. Drive. Fast."
"They did not try to kill me."
"Drive." She drove. The mask of the well-to-do young Hausfrau on her way back from the market now hung in tatters and shreds. Beneath it was something from the cave, something with twitching lips and rolling eyes. Perhaps it had been there all along. They drove about 5 miles and came to a roadside store and air station. "Pull in," Richard said. -041 and counting. "Get out."
"No."
He jammed the gun against her right breast, and she whimpered.
"Don't, please."
"I'm sorry, but there's no more time for you to play prima donna. Get out." She got out, and he slid after her.
"Let me lean on you."
He slung an arm around her shoulders and pointed with the gun at the telephone booth beside the ice dispenser. They began shuffling toward it, a grotesque 2-man vaudeville team. Richards hopped on his good foot. He felt tired. In his mind, he saw the cars crashing, the body flying like a torpedo, the leaping explosion. These scenes played over and over again, like a continuous loop of tape. The store's proprietor, an old pal with white hair and scrawny legs hidden by a dirty butcher's apron, came out and stared at them with worried eyes.
"Hey," he said mildly, "I don't want you here. I got a family. Go down the road. Please, I don't want no trouble."
"Go inside, Pop," Richard said. The man went. Richard slid loosely into the booth, breathing through his mouth, and fumbled 50 cents into the coin horn. Holding the gun and receiver in one hand, he punched O.
"What exchange is this, operator?"
"Rockland, sir."
"Put me through to the local newsy hookup, please."
"You may dial that, sir. The number is..."
"You dial it."
"Do you wish?"
"Just dial it."
"Yes, sir," she said, unruffled.
There were clicks and pops in Richard's ear. Blood had darkened his shirt to a dirty purple color. He looked away from it. It made him feel ill. "Rockland Newsy," a voice said in Richards' ear. "Free V tabloid number 6943. "This is Ben Richards." There was a long silence. Then, "Look, maggot, I like a joke as well as the next guy, but this has been a long, hard..." "Shut up. You're going to get confirmation of this in 10 minutes at the outside. You can get it now if you've got a police band radio."
"I..."
Just a second.
There was the clunk of a dropping phone on the other end, and a faint wailing sound. When the phone was picked up, the voice was hard and businesslike with an undercurrent of excitement.
Where are you, fella? Half the cops in eastern Maine just went through Rockland at about 110.
Richards craned his neck at the sign over the store.
A place called Gilly's Town Line Store and Air Stop on U.S. 1, you know it?
Yeah, just...
Listen to me, maggot. I didn't call to give you my life story. Get some photogs out here, quick, and get this on the air. Red news break top. I've got a hostage. Her name is Amelia Williams from...
He looked at her.
Falmouth, she said miserably. From Falmouth. Safe conduct or I'll kill her.
Jesus, I smell the Pulitzer Prize.
No, you just shit your pants, that's all, Richard said. He felt lightheaded. You get the word out. I want the state pigs to find out everyone knows I'm not alone. Three of them at a roadblock tried to blow us up.
What happened to the cops?
I killed them.
All three? Hot damn.
The voice pulled away from the phone, yelled distantly,
Vicky, open the national cable.
I'm going to kill her if they shoot, Richard said, simultaneously trying to inject sincerity into his voice and to remember all the old gangster movies he had seen on TV as a kid. If they want to save the girl, they better let me through.
When?
Richards hung up and hopped clumsily out of the booth.
Help me.
She put an arm around him, grimacing at the blood.
See what you're getting yourself into?
Yes.
This is madness. You're going to be killed.
Drive north, he mumbled. Just drive north.
He slid into the car, breathing hard. The world insisted on going in and out. High, atonal music jangled in his ears. She pulled out and onto the road. His blood had smeared on her smart green and black striped blouse. The old man, Gilly, cracked the screen door open and poked out a very old Polaroid camera. He clicked the shutter, pulled the tape, and waited. His face was painted with horror and excitement and delight. In the distance, rising and converging, sirens. -040 and counting. They traveled 5 miles before people began running out onto their lawns to watch them pass. Many had cameras, and Richards relaxed.
They were shooting at the air caps at that roadblock, she said quietly.
It was a mistake. That's what it was, a mistake. If that maggot was aiming for an air cap when he put out the windshield, there must have been a sight on that pistol 3 feet high.
It was a mistake.
They were entering the residential district of what Richards assumed was Rockland. Summer homes, dirt roads leading down to beachfront cottages, Breeze Inn, private road, just me and Patty.
Keep out,
Elizabeth's Rest. Trespassers will be shot. Cloud high. 5,000 volts. Set a spell. Guard dogs on patrol. Unhealthy eyes and avid faces peering at them from behind trees like Cheshire cats. The blare of battery-powered freebies came through the shattered windshield. A crazy, weird air of carnival about everything.
These people, Richard said, only want to see someone bleed. The more, the better.
They would just as soon it was both of us. Can you believe that?
No.
Then I salute you.
An older man with silvery barbershop hair, wearing Madras shorts that came down over his knees, ran out to the edge of the road. He was carrying a huge camera with a cobra-like telephoto lens. He began snapping pictures wildly, bending and dipping. His legs were fish-belly white. Richards burst into a sudden bray of laughter that made Amelia jump.
What?
He's still got the lens cover on, Richard said. He's still got...
But laughter overcame him. Cars crowded the shoulders as they topped a long, slowly rising hill and began to descend toward the clustered town of Rockland itself. Perhaps it had once been a picturesque seacoast fishing village full of Winslow Homer men in yellow rain slickers who went out in small boats to trap the wily lobster. If so, it was long gone. There was a huge shopping center on either side of the road, a main street strip of honky-tonks, bars, and auto-slot emporiums. There were neat middle-class homes overlooking the main drag from the heights, and a growing slum looking up from the rancid edge of the water. The sea at the horizon was yet unchanged.
It glittered blue and ageless, full of dancing points and nets of light in the late afternoon sun. They began the descent, and there were two police cars parked across the road. The blue lights flicked, flicked, flicked jaggedly, crazy and out of sync with each other. Parked at an angle on the left embankment was an armored car with a short, stubby cannon barrel tracking them.
"You're done," she said softly, almost regretfully. "Do I have to die, too?"
"Stop 50 yards from the roadblock and do your stuff," Richard said. He slid down in the seat. A nervous tic stitched his face. She stopped and opened the car door, but did not lean out. The air was dead silent. "A hush falls over the crowd," Richard thought ironically.
"I'm scared," she said. "Please, I'm so scared."
"They won't shoot you," he said. "There are too many people. You can't kill hostages unless no one is watching. Those are the rules of the game." She looked at him for a moment, and he suddenly wished they could have a cup of coffee together. He would listen carefully to her conversation and stir real cream into his hot drink, her treat, of course. Then they could discuss the possibilities of social inequity, the way your socks always fall down when you're wearing rubber boots, and the importance of being earnest. "Go on, Mrs. Williams," he said with soft, tense mockery. "The eyes of the world are upon you." She leaned out. Six police cars and another armored van had pulled up 30 feet behind them, blocking their retreat. He thought, "Now the only way out is straight up to heaven." -039 and counting.
"My name is Amelia Williams. Benjamin Richards is holding me hostage. If you don't give us safe conduct, he says he'll kill me."
Silence for a moment, so complete that Richards could hear the faraway honk of some distant yacht's air horn. Then, asexual, blaring, amplified, "We want to talk to Ben Richards." "No," Richards said swiftly.
"He says he won't."
"Come out of the car, madam."
"He'll kill me," she cried wildly. "Don't you listen? Some men almost killed us back there. He says you don't care who you kill. My God, is he right?"
A hoarse voice in the crowd yelled, "Let her through." "Come out of the car or we'll shoot." "Let her through! Let her through!" The crowd had taken up the chant like eager fans at a killball match. "Come out!" The crowd drowned it out. From somewhere, a rock flew. A police car windshield starred into a matrix of cracks. There was suddenly a rev of motors, and the two cruisers began to pull apart, opening a narrow slot of pavement. The crowd cheered happily and then fell silent, waiting for the next act. "All civilians leave the area," the bullhorn chanted. "There may be shooting. All civilians leave the area, or you may be charged with obstruction and unlawful assembly. The penalty for obstruction and unlawful assembly is 10 years in the state penitentiary, or a fine of $10,000, or both. Clear the area. Clear the area." "Yeah, so no one will see you shoot the girl," a hysterical voice yelled. "Screw all pigs." The crowd didn't move. A yellow and black newsie-mobile had pulled up with a flashy screech. Two men jumped out and began setting up a camera. Two cops rushed over, and there was a short, savage scuffle for the possession of the camera. Then one of the cops yanked it free, picked it up with a tripod, and smashed it on the road. One of the newsmen tried to reach the cop that had done it, and was clubbed. A small boy darted out of the crowd and fired a rock at the back of a cop's head. Blood splattered the road as the cop fell over. A half dozen more descended on the boy, bearing him off. Incredibly, small and savage fist fights had begun on the sidelines between the well-dressed townfolk and the rattier slum dwellers. A woman in a ripped and faded house dress suddenly descended on a plump matron and began to pull her hair. They fell heavily to the road and began to roll on the macadam, kicking and screaming.
"My God," Amelia said sickly.
"What's happening?" Richards asked. He dared look no higher than the clock on the dashboard.
"Fights. Police hitting people. Someone broke Anuzzi's camera."
"Give up, Richards. Come out."
"Drive on," Richards said softly.
The air car jerked forward erratically.
"They'll shoot for the air caps," she said.
"Then wait until you have to come out."
"They won't," Richards said.
"Why?" "They're too dumb."
"They didn't."
They proceeded slowly past the ranked police cars and the bug-eyed spectators. They had split themselves into two groups in unconscious segregation. On one side of the road were the middle and upper-class citizens, the ladies who had their hair done at the beauty parlor, the men who wore arrow shirts and loafers. Fellows wearing coveralls with company names on the back and their own names stitched in gold thread over the breast pockets. Women like Amelia Williams herself, dressed for the market and the shops. Their faces were different in all ways, but similar in one. They looked oddly incomplete, like pictures with holes for eyes, or a jigsaw puzzle with a minor piece missing. It was a lack of desperation. Richards thought, no wolves howled in these bellies. These minds were not filled with rotted, crazed dreams or mad hopes. These people were on the right side of the road, the side that faced the combination marina and country club they were just passing. On the other side, the left, were the poor people. Red noses with burst veins, flattened, sagging breasts, stringy hair, white socks, cold sores, pimples, the blank and hanging mouths of idiocy. The police were deployed more heavily here, and more were coming all the time. Richards was not surprised at the swiftness and the heaviness of their crunch, despite the suddenness of his appearance. Even here in Boondocks, USA, the club and the gun were kept near to hand. The dogs were kept hungry in the kennel. The poor break into summer cottages closed for autumn and winter. The poor crash supermarts in sub-teen gangs. The poor have been known to soap badly spelled obscenities on shop windows. The poor always have itchy assholes, and the sight of naga hide and chrome and $200 suits and fat bellies have been known to make the mouths of the poor fill with angry spit. And the poor must have their Jack Johnson, their Muhammad Ali, their Clyde Barrow. They stood and watched. Here on the right, folks, we have the summer people, Richards thought. Fat and sloppy, but heavy with armor. On the left, weighing in at only 130, but a scrappy contender with a mean and rolling eyeball, we have the hungry honkies. Theirs are the politics of starvation. They'd roll Christ himself for a pound of salami. Polarization comes to West Sticksville. Watch out for these two contenders, though. They don't stay in the ring. They have a tendency to fight in the $10 seats. Can we find a goat to hang up for both of them? Slowly, rolling at 30, Ben Richards passed between them. -038 and counting. An hour passed. It was 4 o'clock. Shadows crawled across the road. Richards slumped down below eye level in his seat, floated in and out of consciousness effortlessly, yet clumsily pulled his shirt out of his pants to look at the new wound. The bullet had dug a deep and ugly canal in his side that had bled a great deal. The blood had clotted, but grudgingly. When he had to move quickly again, the wound would rip open and bleed a great deal more. It didn't matter. They were going to blow him up. In the face of this massive armory, his plan was a joke. He would go ahead with it, fill in the blanks until there was an accident and the air car was blown into bent bolts and shards of metal. Terrible accident. The trooper has been suspended pending a full investigation. Regret the loss of innocent life. All this buried in the last newsy of the day, between the stock market report and the Pope's latest pronouncement. But it was only reflex. He had become increasingly worried about Amelia Williams, whose big mistake had been picking Wednesday morning to do her marketing. "There are tanks out there," she said suddenly. Her voice was light, chatty, hysterical. "Can you imagine it? Can you..." She began to cry. Richards waited. Finally he said, "What town are we in?"
Winterport, the science said. "Oh, I can't. I can't wait for them to do it. I can't."
"Okay," he said. She blinked slowly, giving an infinitesimal shake of her head as if to clear it.
"What?"
"Stop. Get out."
"But they'll kill you."
"Yes, but there won't be any blood. You won't see any blood. They've got enough firepower out there to vaporize me and the car, too."
"You're lying. You'll kill me."
The gun had been dangling between his knees. He dropped it on the floor. It clunked harmlessly on the rubber floor mat.
"I want some pot," she said mindlessly. "Oh, God, I want to be high. Why didn't you wait for the next car? Jesus! Jesus!"
Richards began to laugh.
He laughed in wheezy, shallow-chested heaves that still hurt his side. He closed his eyes and laughed until tears oozed out from under the lids.
"It's cold in here with that broken windshield," she said irrelevantly. "Turn on the heater."
Her face was a pale blotch in the shadows of late afternoon. -037 and counting. "We're in Derry," she said. The streets were black with people. They hung over roof ledges and sat on balconies and verandas from which the summer furniture had been removed. They ate sandwiches and fried chicken from greasy buckets.
"Are there jetport signs?"
"Yes, I'm following them. They'll just close the gates."
"I'll just threaten to kill you again if they do."
"Are you going to skyjack a plane?"
"I'm going to try."
"You can't."
"I'm sure you're right."
They made a right, then a left. Bullhorns exhorted the crowd monotonously to move back to disperse. "Is she really your wife, that woman in the pictures?"
"Yes. Her name is Sheila. Our baby, Kathy, is 1.5 years old. She had the flu. Maybe she's better now. That's how I got into this."
A helicopter buzzed them, leaving a huge arachnid shadow on the road ahead. A grossly amplified voice exhorted Richards to let the woman go. When it was gone and they could speak again, she said, "Your wife looks like a little tramp. She could take better care of herself."
"The picture was doctored," Richards said tonelessly.
"They would do that?"
"They would do that."
"The jetport, we're coming up to it."
"Are the gates shut?"
"I can't see.
Wait.
Open, but blocked. A tank. It's pointing its shooter at us."
"Drive to within 30 feet of it and stop."
The car crawled slowly down the 4-lane access road between the parked police cars, between the ceaseless scream and babble of the crowd. A sign loomed over them, "Void Airfield." The woman could see an electrified cyclone fence which crossed a marshy, worthless sort of field on both sides of the road. Straight ahead was a combination information booth and check-in point on a traffic island. Beyond that was the main gate, blocked by an A-62 tank capable of firing 1/4 megaton shells from its cannon. Farther on, a confusion of roads and parking lots, all tending toward the complex jet-lined terminals that blocked the runways from view. A huge control tower bulked over everything like an H.G. Wells Martian, the westering sun glaring off its polarized bank of windows and turning them to fire. Employees and passengers alike had crowded down to the nearest parking lot, where they were being held back by more police. There was a pulsing, heavy whine in their ears, and Amelia saw a steel-gray Lockheed GA Superbird rising into a flat, powerful climb from one of the runways behind the main buildings. "Richards!" She jumped and looked at him, frightened. He waved his hand at her nonchalantly. "It's all right, Ma. I'm only dying." "You're not allowed inside," the huge amplified voice admonished him. "Let the woman go. Step out." "What now?" she asked. "It's a standoff. They'll just wait until..."
"Let's push them a little farther," Richard said. "They'll bluff along a little more. Lean out. Tell them I'm hurt and half crazy. Tell them I want to give up to the airline police."
"You want to do what?"
"The airline police are neither state enforcement nor federal. They've been international ever since the UN Treaty of 1995. There used to be a story that if you gave up to them, you'd get amnesty. Sort of like landing on free parking in Monopoly. Full of shit, of course. They turn you over to the hunters, and the hunters drag you out in back of the barn."
She winced.
"But maybe they'll think I believe it, or that I fooled myself into believing it. Go ahead and tell them." She leaned out, and Richards tensed. If there was going to be an unfortunate accident which would remove Amelia from the picture, it would probably happen now. Her head and upper body were clearly and cleanly exposed to 1,000 guns. One squeeze on one trigger, and the entire farce would come to a quick end.
"Ben Richards wants to give up to the airline police," she cried. "He's shot in 2 places.
She threw a terrified glance over her shoulder and her voice broke, high and clear in the sudden silence the diminishing jet had left.
He's been out of his mind half the time, and God, I'm so frightened. Please, please, please.
The cameras were recording it all, sending it on a live feed that would be broadcast all over North America and half the world in a matter of minutes. That was good. That was fine. Richards felt tension stiffen his limbs again, and knew he was beginning to hope. Silence for a moment. There was a conference going on behind the checkpoint booth. Very good, Richard said softly. She looked at him. Do you think it's hard to sound frightened? We're not in this together, whatever you think. I only want you to go away. Richards noticed for the first time how perfect her breasts were beneath the blood-stained black and green blouse. How perfect and how precious. There was a sudden grinding roar, and she screamed aloud. It's the tank, he said. It's okay, just the tank.
It's moving, she said. They're going to let us in.
Richards, you will proceed to Lot 16. Airline police will be waiting there to take you into custody. All right, he said thinly. Drive on. When you get a half a mile inside the gate, stop.
You're going to get me killed, she said hopelessly.
All I need to do is use the bathroom and you're going to get me killed.
The air car lifted 4 inches and hummed smoothly forward. Richards crouched going through the gate, anticipating a possible ambush, but there was none. The smooth blacktop curved sedately toward the main buildings. A sign with a pointing arrow informed them that this was the way to lots 16 through 20. Here the police were standing and kneeling behind yellow barricades. Richards knew that at the slightest suspicious move, they would tear the air car apart. Now stop, he said, and she did. The reaction was instantaneous. Richards, move immediately to Lot 16. Tell them that I want a bullhorn, Richards said softly to her. They are to leave one in the road 20 yards up. I want to talk to them. She cried his message, and then they waited. A moment later, a man in a blue uniform trotted out into the road and laid an electric bullhorn down. He stood there for a moment, perhaps savoring the realization that he was being seen by 500 million people, and then withdrew to barricaded anonymity again. Go ahead, he told her. They crept up to the bullhorn, and when the driver's side door was even with it, she opened the door and pulled it in. It was red and white. The letters G and A, embossed over a thunderbolt, were on the side. Okay, he said. How far are we from the main building? She squinted.
A quarter of a mile, I guess.
How far are we from Lot 16?
Half that.
Good. That's good, yeah. He realized he was compulsively biting his lips and tried to make himself stop. His head hurt. His entire body ached from adrenaline. Keep driving. Go up to the entrance of Lot 16 and then stop.
Then what?
He smiled tightly and unhappily. That, he said, is going to be the site of Richards' last stand. -036 and counting. When she stopped the car at the entrance of the parking lot, the reaction was quick and immediate. Keep moving, the bullhorn prodded. The airport police are inside, as specified. Richards raised his own bullhorn for the first time. 10 minutes, he said. I have to think.
Silence again. Don't you realize you're pushing them to do it? She asked him in a strange, controlled voice.
He uttered a weird, squeezed giggle that sounded like steam under high pressure escaping from a teapot. They know I'm getting set to screw them. They don't know how.
You can't, she said. Don't you see that yet?
Maybe I can, he said. -035 and counting. Listen. When the games first started, people said they were the world's greatest entertainment because there had never been anything like them. But nothing's that original. There were the gladiators in Rome who did the same thing. And there's another game, too. Poker. In poker, the highest hand is a royal straight flush in spades. And the toughest kind of poker is 5-card stud. 4 cards up on the table and 1 in the hole.
For nickels and dimes, anyone can stay in the game. It costs you maybe half a buck to see the other guy's hole card. But when you push the stakes up, the hole card starts to look bigger and bigger. After a dozen rounds of betting, with your life savings and car and house on the line, that hole card stands taller than Mount Everest. The running man is like that. Only I'm not supposed to have any money to bet with. They've got the men, the firepower, and the time. We're playing with their cards and their chips in their casino. When I'm caught, I'm supposed to fold. But maybe I stacked the deck a bit. I called the Newsy line in Rockland. The Newsies, that's my 10 of spades. They had to give me safe conduct because everyone was watching. There were no more chances for neat disposal after that first roadblock. It's funny, too, because it's the freebie that gives the network the clout that it has. If you see it on the freebie, it must be true. So if the whole country saw the police murder my hostage, a well-to-do middle-class female hostage, they would have to believe it. They can't risk it. The system is laboring under too much suspension of belief now. Funny, huh? My people are here. There's been trouble on the road already. If the troopers and the hunters turn all their guns on us, something nasty might happen. A man told me to stay near my own people. He was more right than he knew. One of the reasons they've been handling me with the kid gloves on is because my people are here. My people, they're the Jack of Spades. The queen, the lady in the affair, is you. I'm the king, the black man with the sword. These are my up cards. The media, the possibility of real trouble, you, me. Together, they're nothing. A pair will take them. Without the ace of spades, it's junk. With the ace, it's unbeatable. He suddenly picked up her handbag, an imitation alligator skin clutch purse with a small silver chain. He stuffed it into his coat pocket, where it bulged prominently. I haven't got the ace, he said softly. With a little more forethought, I could have had it. But I do have a hole card, one they can't see. So I'm going to run a bluff. You don't have a chance, she said hollowly. What can you do with my bag? Shoot them with a lipstick? I think that they've been playing a crooked game so long that they'll fold. I think they are yellow straight through from the back to belly. Richards, 10 minutes are up. Richards put the bullhorn to his lips. -034, and counting. Listen to me carefully. His voice boomed and rolled across the flat Jetport acres. Police waited tensely. The crowd shuffled. I am carrying 12 pounds of Dynacor high-impact plastic explosive in my coat pocket, the variety they call Black Irish. 12 pounds is enough to take out everything and everyone within a third of a mile, and probably enough to explode the Jetport fuel storage tanks. If you don't follow my instructions to the letter, I'll blow you all to hell. A General Atomics imploder ring is set into the explosive. I have it pulled out to half-cock. One jiggle, and you can all put your heads between your legs and kiss your asses goodbye. There were screams from the crowd, followed by sudden tide-like movement. The police at the barricades suddenly found they had no one to hold back. Men and women were tearing across roads and fields, streaming out the gates and scaling the cyclone fence around the Jetport. Their faces were blank and avid with panic. The police shuffled uneasily. On no face did Amelia Williams see disbelief. Richards, the huge voice boomed. That's a lie. Come out. I am coming out, he boomed back. But before I do, let me give you your marching orders. I want a jet fully fueled and ready to fly with a skeleton crew. This jet will be a Lockheed GA or a Delta Supersonic. The range must be at least 2,000 miles. This will be ready in 90 minutes. Cameras reeling and cranking away, flashbulbs popping.
The press looked uneasy, too, but of course there was the psychic pressure of those 500 million watchers to be considered. They were real. The job was real. And Richards's 12 pounds of black Irish might be just a figment of his admirable criminal mentality. Richards! A man dressed only in dark slacks and a white shirt rolled up to the elbows in spite of the fall chill strolled out from behind a gaggle of unmarked cars 50 yards beyond Lot 16. He was carrying a bullhorn larger than Richards's. From this distance, Amelia could see only that he was wearing small spectacles. They flashed in the dying sunlight. I am Evan McCone. He knew the name, of course. It was supposed to strike fear into his heart. He was not surprised to find that it did strike fear into his heart. Evan McCone was the chief hunter, a direct descendant of J. Edgar Hoover and Heinrich Himmler, he thought. The personification of the steel inside the network's cathode glove. A boogeyman. A name to frighten bad children with. If you don't stop playing with matches, Johnny, I'll let Evan McCone out of your closet. Fleetingly, in the eye of memory, he recalled a dream voice. Are you the man, little brother? You're lying, Richards. We know it. A man without a GA rating has no way of getting Dimecor. Let the woman go and come out. We don't want to have to kill her, too. Amelia made a weak, wretched hissing noise. End of side 20. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.